So this practice that we're doing, which is called Zen practice or Zen Buddhism, attracts a certain kind of individual, at least those who stick with it and, you know, dig their teeth into it. It attracts someone who starts out really needing meaning, a deep meaning to things. Perhaps a sense that things are lacking in some way, that some path can add back the reason, the meaning. And at the same time, paradoxically, people attracted to this particular path are people who have a great distrust for meaning, who have perhaps experienced other paths and just can't adapt to or adopt the sets of meanings that these paths give to their life. So the person attracted to this path is kind of on what they call the horns of a dilemma, needing meaning and distrusting meaning. And I find that particularly refreshing. It's just wonderful. Sometimes I call it the imbecility of this practice. I love that about this practice. It plunges you into a kind of an imbecilic state, where meaning, the original attractant to this path, little by little becomes irrelevant. In fact, it blocks you. You have to leave it behind. We've talked about this many times, about the meaning of thinking versus the sensation of thinking. There it is right there. Now, at this particular time of year, and the particular year it is, we're in this political season. And it's just very interesting, disheartening, entertaining, frightening to watch the kind of meanings put onto events and affiliations that you see politicians attributing and their followers. And it seems that those politicians that have the most bombastic oppositional divided view of the world, an us against them view, which then bleeds over into an acceptance of and even a validation of and a recommendation for violence, are those who have the deepest attraction to, and their followers, meaning. The meaning of things, what I believe in. You know that term, value voter, to be a value voter. You vote because of values that you hold, which are really deep meanings that you give to the world that feel so real, so given, so intrinsic, that there's not even any debate that they're true in your mind. And this gets us into the whole realm of religion, and now we're back to where Zen Buddhism fits in with all the other religions, and whether meaning is important or not important. When you think about these values, how important it is to be kind to others, to be generous, the Ten Commandments, all of these things. One of the underlying teachings in religions is that if you do something bad, there'll be a bad outcome, and if you do something good, there'll be a good outcome. So the values that you put on things when you really clearly look at it, have more to do with what's going to come as a result of your action than what your action is truly deeply motivated by. Are you more moral because you hold to the Ten Commandments or whatever set of credos or ten bodhisattva precepts you might ascribe to, because you fear consequences, or you hope that when you get to the pearly gates you'll be viewed favorably because of all the wonderful things you did? Is that preferable to someone who is, let's say, an atheist, who ascribes to no particular sets of values, but tries deep within to find some resonation with the world, with others, with nature, from which some intrinsic response, some natural response arises? Is that less moral, less ethical than someone who holds to beliefs, holds to a credo, and then defends it violently against those who might slight it, not believe in it? So we get into this whole realm of meanings and how difficult and tricky and sticky it is for human beings. Why do we need meaning at all, when you really look at it clearly? There was a psychiatrist, his name was Viktor Frankl. He was a Holocaust survivor. He actually spent time in a concentration camp. And he observed people very closely there, and himself, the process he went through. He ended up writing a book about his experiences and about what he felt was very fundamental. And the title of the book was Man's Search for Meaning. Now, I think it's times when we are most afraid, and certainly politicians will prey upon events to create fear, when we are most unhappy, when we are most frustrated, that we seem to require a meaning to what we're doing. We, in a sense, resort to meaning or revert to meaning. I'll give you an example. I go to Cozumel from time to time to go diving. Now, in between the diving, there's some time where you can actually rent these motorbikes and drive south on the island and get to this really remote area where there are beautiful, empty beaches. And usually it's very warm, it's about 85, sometimes even warmer, with a gentle ocean breeze and big surf. And near the end of this road is a bar that I've been to many times. And it's a really neat place, it's all open air, and they have some hammocks. So you go up to the bar, you order a Corona, ask for a lime in it, classic Mexican beverage. And you go out and you lie on the hammock and you look out at the ocean and you feel the wind blowing in your face. And you stare at this Corona and you imagine you're in a Corona commercial. Now, what meaning do I need at that moment? Do I resort to meaning? Do I need a meaning for this? What is the meaning of it? Now, let's flash way back to a time when I was a student at UMass Medical School, and in the first 2 years, you literally, it's like someone put a funnel in your skull and have just are cramming information in there, cramming. It is such a painful, frustrating, difficult process. I remember on the weekend, my wife would, you know, we'd get in the car, we didn't have any kids back then, and our weekend out was her driving the car and my sitting in the front seat driving through the country, and I was reading medical texts, and that was our weekend. What meaning did I need to give that? This was for the sake of a future career, I was going to help people, I was going to make a lot of money, whatever. There needed to be a meaning here because there was something painful, something taking both of us away from things we would much rather have been doing. So you can see very clearly the role that meaning plays. It's like an insulator. It's like a sugar coating. We resort to it when we're afraid, when we're unhappy, when we're stressed, when there's something distasteful we need to do. But it's added on. It's something we add. We add it via thinking. We have an experience, and we add to it thinking. The thinking has a purpose. The purpose is to keep us going, to make us feel safer, to make us feel affiliated so that we're not so alone. And the end result will be that things become a little less scary, a little less painful, but perhaps there are some very negative aspects to this as well. We're living kind of once removed. There's an insulator between us and our experience. It's our thinking, it's the meanings, and how we have to defend those meanings and justify those meanings and all the rest of it. There was one Taisho I gave where I talked about taking off the gloves of conceptual thinking. That we use conceptual thinking to manipulate the world, to allow us to get tasks done in a way that seems more pleasant. And yet, these gloves make it very hard to feel the actual thing we're trying to grasp with our concepts, to really feel it directly. And as a result of this comes a sense of emptiness, frustration, sense of lacking. Maybe I need a different pair of gloves. Maybe these gloves are the wrong gloves. So we keep trying on different gloves. But it never quite solves this sense. And this individual may, by luck, stumble over, stub their toe on a practice like the one we're doing here, and learn that, oh, maybe I need to take off the gloves. And then here we are. So we learn a practice called mindfulness. And one of the very first things we learn through the actual practice is what seems to get in between ourselves and our experience, which, if there was nothing between ourselves and the experience, would be called mindfulness, is what? Is thinking. Thinking arises. The brain secretes thoughts. Then we learn, hopefully, that thoughts have meanings associated with them that we give them. They're not intrinsic to the thoughts. Thinking is a chemical, electrical process in the brain, which is the sensory organ for thinking. Added onto these thoughts are meanings which we give them. And if we let go of the meaning and simply, rather than fighting them, sense the thinking as a sensation, very abruptly, very suddenly, we are back in the sphere of sensation. Sensation without any meaning added. This is the imbecility of this practice. We are entering the world of sensation. Now we need to do this pretty quickly. At the beginning of Zen practice, we need to learn how to do this. We have various techniques, following the breath, counting the breath, viewing thoughts as clouds passing in front of your eyes, sensing the sensation of thinking and letting go of its meaning, all these things. And instantly, although we don't yet know it, when we actually do this and we take off the gloves of conceptual thinking, we are manifesting in that moment Samyutara Samyak Sambodhi, complete unexcelled enlightenment. We don't know it yet, but we are manifesting it directly. There are no steps here. It's a sudden leap into the actual world of sensation. Dogen said that. He said, the earnest, wholehearted zazen of the beginner encompasses the entire sphere of Buddhism. So that's our first and essential step. We have ways of doing it. The koan mu, for example, is a way of stepping directly into sensation. We start with trying to find its meaning. What is the meaning of this mu? Why did Joshu answer the monk who said, does even a lowly cur like a dog have Buddha nature? Why did he answer mu? And we get hung up on that. We think about it. We ponder it. In traditional Japanese monasteries, you're not told much about this. You're left to twist in the wind, hang on tenterhooks for a long time until you yourself come upon the realization that searching for the meaning of this statement is going in the wrong direction. What we do here is we point it out pretty quickly, just so you don't have to spin your wheels too much. Now you enter this world of sensation, but there still seems to be something. I'm in this world, but it's something. I'm not holding on to meaning. I'm experiencing moment by moment this world. There still seems to be some separation. What is that? I'm here and Mu is there. What is that? That's a much more deeply held, one might say unconscious, meaning, idea, concept. The concept of an entity inside, an entity with characteristics that stands apart from the world of sensation. This is not so easy to grapple with. This is much more automatic, much deeper. We can put down the superficial meanings. It's hard to get past this one. There are techniques to do this. The koan, who am I, actually directly goes into this. We sense this, we pick it up. So just like we let go of the meaning of our thoughts, our superficial thoughts, value judgments, affiliations, ideas about the world, names, dividing lines. At the same time, in this level of meaning, this unconscious sense of standing apart, we literally and intentionally bring up the sensation of being separate, the sensation of being a self. We look directly at it, and we profoundly ask ourselves, what is it that knows this sensation? That's what I am. What knows this sensation? This sensation can't hear. This sensation can't smell incense. So it can't possibly be the knower. This is the path of Zen practice. So I wanted to bring up a koan today that deals with meaning and this unique Zen approach to practice. So this is from Hekigan Roku. It's a wonderful collection of 100 koan. I've mentioned it many times in the past. The koans were compiled by Engo, who was a Song Dynasty Zen master. This is after the Tang Dynasty. There were commentaries on every one of these koans by Secho, who was a famous Zen master of that time. So this one here is case 73. And the case is Basso. He was also a very famous, probably one of the greatest Tang Dynasty masters. He had many successors, including Hyakujo, of Hyakujo's Fox and several other koan. So the title of this case is Basso and the 100 Negations. So I'll read you the case. Actually, let's read first the introduction. So the way that these koan are assembled is there's an introduction by Engo, which points us in a certain direction. It whets our appetite. It is a tease and a challenge. Then the main case is presented, and then there's a verse or commentary by Setra. So I'll read Engo's introduction to this. This is Basso and the 100 Negations. Preaching is non-preaching and non-teaching. Hearing is non-hearing and non-attaining. If preaching is non-preaching and non-teaching, what use is there in preaching? If hearing is non-hearing and non-attaining, what use is there in hearing? But this non-preaching and non-hearing are worth something. You are listening to me now, preaching here. How can we escape this criticism? Those who have eyes see the following. What a tease. What a tease. But this in the context of what we just talked about. Meaning. Needing meaning. But knowing we have to take a leap beyond meaning. This imbecility of this practice, going directly, stripping meaning off and going directly to your experience. That the minute we add meaning, we've added gloves, we put gloves on. We can't feel the world directly. So he says here, preaching is non-preaching and non-teaching. Something else, very direct. Hearing the preaching. Is non-hearing and non-attaining. How can you attain something that you are originally? If preaching is non-preaching and non-teaching, what use is there in preaching? This is a kind of a hook. There is some use in it. If hearing is non-hearing and non-attaining, what use is there in hearing? And he says, they are worth something. So let's go on to the case. So this is the main subject. A monk said to Taishi, independent of the four propositions and transcending the 100 negations, tell me plainly the meaning of Bodhidharma's coming from the West. So I want to just stop here for a sec, define these terms. So the four propositions are part of Buddhist dialectic. Buddhism has a very highly evolved philosophical and even psychological system. Very broad, deep, and profound set of teachings that began 500 years BC and has evolved up until the present. And one of the aspects of the dialectic are these four propositions, which is things exist. These are basic propositions. Things exist. Second one is things do not exist. The third one is things both exist and do not exist. And the fourth one is things neither exist nor not exist, is the four propositions. What are the 100 negations? I believe Nagarjuna was the Buddhist teacher who would teach by saying what the truth isn't. Remember about this preaching and non-preaching, hearing and non-hearing and non-attaining. So he would say, not this, not this, not this. He would pull the rug out from every idea, every concept, every meaning, until something was left that you can directly contact. So these two approaches of showing the paradoxical simultaneous existence or non-existence of opposites and saying not this, not this, not this are two classic approaches to teaching in Buddhism. But this student wanted something beyond that. This student, this monk, asked Taishi, a master, independent of the four propositions and transcending the 100 negations, Tell me plainly the meaning of Bodhidharma's coming from the West. This is another famous statement. The meaning of Bodhidharma's coming from the West. You all know the story. Bodhidharma's the first Zen patriarch. He was the 28th Indian patriarch or successor of the Buddha. And he took a very arduous, difficult, dangerous trip from India through the South China Sea to China to bring the Dharma to China. It took him 3 years to get there. And when he got there, he met this great emperor, the Emperor Wu of Liang. This is another koan in the Hekigan Roku, and also, I believe, is in the Mulan Khan. But the Emperor of Liang said to him, I've built many temples, and I've built so many places of study of Buddhism before you came here, because it came with other folks, but you know, we've never had a great master come, and now finally we have you. Let me ask you, what is the merit of all this that I've done? Emperor Liang asked Bodhidharma. Bodhidharma said, no merit whatsoever. And he said, well, Liang said, isn't there merit to all of this wonderful acts that I've done? Haven't I done some very holy things here? Bodhidharma said, vast emptiness, no holiness. Then the emperor asked him, well, who is this before me then, this great master? And his answer was, I don't know. I don't know. So the classic question in Zen was, what is the meaning of Bodhidharma coming from the West? If you came there, there's no holiness, vast emptiness. Who's this before me? I don't know. What's the meaning? What was his intention? What was he showing? What was he teaching? So this question, what is the meaning of Bodhidharma's coming from the West? Now, I take it that this student, because he prefaced his question with, don't tell me about the four propositions. Don't tell me about the 100 negations. Tell me directly. I want to know directly, what is the meaning of Zen? What is the meaning of this practice? What is the meaning of Bodhidharma coming from the West? So he asked this of Taishi. So Taishi is, I think, it's a name for Basso, the master Basso. So Basso said, today I'm tired and I cannot tell you. I'm having a little trouble reading this. Ask Chizo about it. Chizo was a student of Basso. He says, today I'm tired and I really can't tell you. Ask Chizo. Well, the monk dutifully went over to Chizo. And he said, Chizo said to the monk, when he asked him the question, what's the meaning of Bodhidharma's coming from the West? He said, when did you ask the master? The monk said, he told me to ask you. Chizo said, today I have a headache and I can't tell you about it. Ask Brother Kai. So Kai, this is actually Yakujo Ekai when he was a student. He was older than Chizo. They were both still students of Basso, and they ended up being great masters themselves. So the monk went over to Kai, Brother Kai, and he asked him, who said, coming to this point, I do not understand. The monk told this to Taishi, who said, Zo's head is white. That was the Chizo. Zo's head is white. Kai's head is black. That's the koan. Zo's head is white. Kai's head is black. What does this mean? What's the meaning of this? See how you get tempted into meaning. What does it mean? What does it mean? This monk didn't know how else to approach this sphere except through meaning. What does it mean? What is the meaning of enlightenment? What is the meaning of Buddhism? What is the meaning of this practice? Why am I doing it? Why did Bodhidharma bring it from India to China at great risk, great effort? What does it mean? Tell me directly. Don't tell me through philosophy. I want to know directly. Did he get any answers? What did Basso say? Basso said, "Today I'm tired and I cannot tell you." Was he preaching or not preaching? Was he teaching or not teaching? "Today I'm tired, I can't tell you." Ask Chizo about it. Well, monk evidently didn't get it right at that point, so he went to Chizo. He said, "Well, why don't you ask the master? Is that teaching or non-teaching? Why don't you ask the master?" "Well, I asked him and he told me to ask you." "Was that hearing or non-hearing? Was that direct? He told me to ask you." Enter this monk now. What did he mean when he said that? Was his whole body and mind involved in that question? "He told me to ask you." Was he totally enveloped by this search? Did it get him at the core? Was he lacking anything at that point? Did he not understand something that he should have understood about Buddhism? "He told me to ask you." See how close we have to get to our life, how totally we have to enter it. And the monk said, "Today I have a headache." "Today I have a headache. I can't tell you about it. Today I've got a headache." "Oh, oh." Is he teaching or not teaching here? What's he pointing at? "Today I have a headache and I can't tell you. I can't give you the meaning you're looking for, but I have a headache. Why don't you ask Brother Kai?" Brother Kai says, he guess he wants to stop torturing this monk that hasn't quite gotten it. He's going to point very, very directly now. Coming to this point, "I do not understand. After all my practice, after all the years of sitting, I have completely left understanding behind. I don't understand." Some people say, "When walking, just walk. When eating, just eat." This is that word, just. Now remember, when the beginning student in Zazen lets go of the meaning of their thoughts without doing any battle with thoughts, just experiences the sensation of thoughts, then they're just thinking. A smell of incense wafts by. They're just smelling. What understanding is there at that moment? What need is there for understanding? Coming to this point, "I do not understand." The imbecility of this practice, the beautiful, exquisite imbecility, direct, just. How is this Samyutara Samyak Sambodhi? What is just? When it's just, there's no self. There's no entity. There's no aim. There's no goal. There's no meaning. No purpose. It's very direct. Very connected. It's one thing. So the monk went to Bai Taishi Basso, who said, "Zhou's head is white." "Oh, I've got a headache. Can't tell you. His head is white." Kai, coming to this point, I do not understand. His head is black. What does this mean? Tempting you now with this word. What does this mean? See how the mind just gets so easily trapped in meaning. Maybe one guy had black hair and the other one had white hair. Actually, they both probably had shaved heads. So what does this mean? What does white mean? We can see things when there's light. We see the world. We smell incense. We hear sounds. We feel sensations. We notice thinking. Very direct. It's just. Just. When we ask ourselves, what is it that knows all this? Where is this knower? When we go to the deepest, deepest place, where anything that arises is still an object, it can't possibly be the subject. We go all the way to not knowing. I don't know. Like Bodhidharma standing there in front of Emperor Wu of Lian. Who is this standing in front of me? I don't know. It's a kind of darkness. Kai's head is black. You see the subtlety here? Are they different? Or are they the same? This is a verse that Seto gives to all of this. Zo's head is white. Kai's head is black. It defies understanding. Why does it defy understanding? Only when we go beyond any idea, any thought, any meaning, any understanding, can we really get this. Ah, oh, I've got a headache. Can't tell you. Oh. Or, I don't know. Don't know the answer to your question. Only when we let go of meaning. So it says here, Basso's horses trampled over the world. Rinzai wasn't such a daylight robber. This is a very subtle thing. But Basso's horses were his followers. He had many, many disciples that became great masters. And they, in quotes, trampled all over the world. They brought their teachings so far and wide and trampled on all these superficial meanings. Rinzai was such a great master, they called him the daylight robber. He would rob you blind in broad daylight. In other words, he would take away your most precious understandings, all the meanings you gave the world, all the things you were attached to, all your affiliations. He'd pull them right out from under you in broad daylight. That's how skilled he was. So he says here, Ba's horses trampled all over the world. Rinzai wasn't such a daylight robber as Basso. Putting Basso on a giant pedestal. Putting aside the four propositions, the 100 negations. I'm having a little trouble reading it. You can only nod to yourself. So it said, putting aside the four propositions and the 100 negations, you can only nod to yourself. You can only nod to yourself. What does that mean? I'll leave this without any particular answer. So we'll end there today.